Good afternoon, Bay Area, and welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, an Oakland cartoonist creates a graphic novel about a kid fasting during Ramadan. Then Paul McCartney's photo collection at the DeYoung Museum gives fans rare, intimate pictures of the Beatles. And the Oakland Gay Men's Chorus has a new show and a new artistic director, sharing personal experiences through visual art and songs. That's all coming up after this news update from the BBC. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. For nearly a month, Muslims around the world have been honoring Ramadan. In the Islamic calendar, this is the month where the Quran was first revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. And during this sacred time, many Muslims fast between dawn and sunset. It's a spiritual practice of building sympathy for those who are less fortunate and being closer to Allah. And some youth fast too. So what is that like for a kid? Oakland cartoonist Wahab Agarmi created the graphic novel Almost Sunset, and it's about a middle school boy fasting during Ramadan while struggling to find balance between family, school, and being accepted by his peers. I recently spoke with Wahab about the inspiration behind his book. Wahab, welcome.
Hey, Janae. Thank you for having me.
So I read that you grew up in Oakland, like me. And you learned a lot about other cultures as a kid, but you said you didn't know much about your own culture as far as your Muslim background. Why was that the case? Like, what was going on then?
Oh, man, I just don't think there were many of us. I know when I was growing up, we had like a few families around us, but just by the nature of where I was in Oakland. I lived like blocks away from like the Black History Museum that was like housed in one of the local libraries. I learned about the Ohlone tribe and the shell mounds. We used to take like field trips out there. It's just a matter of where I am and just how small my minority presence is. You know, it's growing now, which is great. You know, there are a lot more Yemeni people here in the area. So, you know, I'm super happy to share what I've been working on with everybody. And honestly, it's been really nice hearing from people. I've been getting phone calls and messages left and right. So it's been really, really nice to see that growth in our community.
And you have kids. Do you feel like they're more informed about their culture? And not just from you, but also too, just even outside of, you know, maybe your family household.
You know, the funny thing is my son, the book is about him. And he says, like, all my friends know what Ramadan is. They know about fasting and this and that. So I think the character in the book is more like me, where maybe they didn't know what it was back in the day or why I was fasting and things like that. So I think just cultural diversity in today's world is a lot easier to grasp. So it's nice to see that for my kids. I don't think they get it yet because they're kids. I don't think they have the hindsight to be like, oh, this is my culture. No, this is why I should be proud of this thing. But, you know, again, the book that I made is hopefully going to be something for them one day, if it's not already.
Well, it's a really great book. And I enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed the illustrations too as well. So where did the inspiration for the story come from? It's about Ramadan, a little boy, Hassan, struggling during fasting, during Ramadan. Are you fasting right now? Because we are kind of towards the end of Ramadan.
We are. This year aligned almost perfectly with the whole month of March. I am fasting. I'm hungry and thirsty. So, you know, but it's okay. I think the inspiration came from loosely based on my family and just what it's like. And then again, like I said, it's more based on what I was like as a kid, maybe, during fasting. So,
and your son too, inspired by your son as well, right?
Yeah, it was definitely inspired by him. He played flag football in real life for like a you know, a season or two. This was always funny because it was just like recreational, and it was just put together by the city of Oakland at one of the local parks. I think it was the Allendale Park. And mm-hmm. it was just like the Bad News Bears. They were so cute and hilarious when they were younger. You know, they would run the wrong way and that kind of stuff. But he's going to kill me when he hears this. But it was fun to imagine like a modern day take on that kind of thing, but to actually include my culture into that and infuse it into the story.
How old is your son?
He's 16 now.
He shouldn't be embarrassed. Those are good memories. I used to love like watching my little cousins and stuff when they had T-ball leagues and all of that. Yeah. So the main character, Hassan, again, is fasting and struggling. And two, you know, he's trying to please his parents and his peers. I was surprised that he didn't tell his friends in the book that he was fasting and why he was fasting. Talk about that. Like, I didn't know if it was shame. I didn't know if it was he thought they wouldn't understand.
I think for me it was more of a, like, I want to fit in kind of thing, or I don't want to inconvenience anybody. I don't want to be special in any kind of way or treated specially. And it just never comes up. So why even bother talking about it kind of a thing? I don't know if it was necessarily shame, but it was just more like, I don't want to deal with this. Even as adults, I think a lot of people compartmentalize aspects of their lives, right? Like sometimes we don't talk about politics, or we don't talk about religion with other people, or and I think that trickles down to kids as well. Even for me, like I don't mention it to my friends just because it's not brought up. They know I'm fasting, but they don't necessarily know when it happens. So like I have one friend in particular, like he's always like, you're fasting right now. I'm like, no, man, it's not all year, every year. It's just once a year kind of thing. So I think for the character in the book is just like, I don't want to deal with this. This is something in my life that's personal and I'll just leave it alone. Later on, there's like a pizza party and it happens like during the day in the book. And he's just like, I'm just going to not go to this thing and they can enjoy their thing. I don't have to be a part of it. So, that's the take that I have on it, you know. But everybody can read into it what they think. One of the reasons that this book was able to get published is the editor that picked it up, he's Jewish, and he used to celebrate Yom Kippur. So he was like, yeah, it was just weird talking about it to other kids, and they just didn't get it, so I just left it alone. He appreciated, you know, the same experience that he had. He saw it in the book, even though it's different religions, so he was like, he felt it.
Yeah. What I like too in the book too as well is family, and especially his relationship with his sister, and just like, you know, they're regular family, you know. And I think we don't see like Muslims portrayed like that often, just as, you know, any other family, sister and brother bickering. I love the presence of cousins. And usually when you see stories, it's like traditional, like nuclear family, mother, father, daughter, son. So it was nice to see the cousins.
So that part of the book is like totally based on my son, because he's got a lot of cousins. When I was growing up, I didn't have a lot of family out here. Like I said, culturally, there weren't a lot of people out here. So he's got like dozens and dozens of cousins on both sides of the family. And all my nieces and nephews are all asking me like, Which one is me in the book? Like, I'm not, because they're like kind of naughty cousins in the book. You know, they're like the devilish side and tempting him. So I'm just like, it's none of you guys. I'm not going to say it's one or the other. But that was definitely inspired by the family side of things, where, you know.
That's funny too, when you write a book and people are like, who, is it me? Is it me?
Yeah, a lot of people were asking like, who's this character, who's that character, and they're all maybe like started with real life people, but they're infused with a lot of me and a lot of, you know, different things that I wanted to pack in there.
And this is your first published book.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And how was that for you? That experience. Oh, that's a big deal.
That was fantastic. That was fantastic, and it continues to be fantastic. I'm so thrilled with the support I've gotten.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. I asked you too about the process of creating this book, because at the very end of the book, on your acknowledgments page, you went through, I guess you were going through some imposter syndrome, as they would call it, because you were like, as you were writing this book, you would question if you were religious enough to tell the story, creative enough, entertaining enough. What made you have some doubts, and like, how did you push through that?
It's a kid's book, but it's a huge story. It's like based off my family, based off my religion, based off my culture. So it's not something I took lightly. I'll say that. But you know, in the end of the day, I was like, this is something I'm gonna do, so I have to do it, and just, you know, powered through, I guess.
Yeah, we go through that. I appreciate that you were honest and made yourself vulnerable to even share that.
Some of the best stories are like that, right? Where if you're going to be vulnerable and tell the truth about yourself, you have to.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Oakland author, artist, Wahab Algarmi, and his book is Almost Sunset, and it's about Ramadan and a little kid just dealing with Ramadan and peers and his family and all that good stuff. I want to go back to Oakland. Oakland is in the comic book.
Yes, Oakland is like little hints in Almost Sunset, and I never draw anything specific. I didn't use any reference for anything, but like there's a giant splash page of the mosque that we go to, and it's like on 31st and Telegraph. One of the parks that he plays soccer in is supposed to be San Antonio Park, where he played a lot of flag football. So there are all these little things here and there, and I always love doing that kind of stuff and putting pictures of my town around.
How has the Bay Area shaped you as an artist? How did you grow as an artist here?
Wow. That's like a 3-hour show. it's been amazing.
Don't have much time.
It's been amazing. It's truly a blessing to have all these different cultures around us. I wish I knew who said this quote, but I often say it like, it's not a melting pot, but it's more like a stir fry, where everybody stays there individual self, but we're all put together, and it's just lovely. I love it.
I've never heard that it's like a stir fry. Did you take classes here? Were there teachers that fostered your drive for creativity or your passion for creativity?
There were a lot. There were a lot. The teaching community, the librarian community, friends, the comic book community is really great out here in the Bay Area. I was living in North Oakland, and there's this little shop in Berkeley, and they were really inviting to the comics making community. It was called Comic Relief. The store no longer exists, but the guy that used to own it, his name was Rory Root, and he used to rent out like a Indian restaurant, like the ballroom next door, and he would just have comic artists come together and hang out and make comics together, and we would do like little jam sessions and things like that. And it was always a wonderful time. And it was all these people, it was like 50 people at one point at the height. And all these things added to who I am today because of that, and that community, which still helps me today. So I'm thankful for them.
Why do you think this story is needed today?
My son's story is always going to be needed, and not just my son's story, but diverse stories are always going to be needed. We're always going to be reminded, because look what's happening right now in the country, where people are so divided and people are getting deported and things like that. And whether you believe it's right or wrong, there's a due process, and you just got to look back, not that far back either, right? World War II was not that long ago, where Japanese people were being interned and prosecuted without due process, and maybe even back to 9/11, where my own people, like, I know, you know, for me, I'm a male, but I got to think of my Muslim sisters who wear hijab, and they go out and how they're treated, right? My wife wears a hijab, and I know she's come back from just going out, and this is before things get heated, where she would say, like, you know, I think this person treated me differently because of this and that, and it's horrible to see that, you know, and I hate that feeling of like, did somebody treat my family differently because they just looked at them and they saw something different? So these kinds of stories that I'm telling, that other people tell, they're always going to be important, because you want to relate to the other person. You're not trying to second guess somebody or or even have any kind of hate for anybody for just what they look like. You know, it's a horrible thing. So hopefully, you know, the more diverse we get and the more stories we tell like these, we can all see the similarities in each other and be kinder to each other.
There was some kind of terrorist attack. This was several years ago. I can't remember if it was something happened here or if it was something overseas. I think it might have been, I can't remember. But the person the people who committed it, they were Muslim. And I had on a head wrap. I wear head wraps a lot. And I remember going to the grocery store and doing people giving me dirty looks. And I think it was because of that incident that happened, because I had never gotten dirty looks before wearing a head wrap.
Yeah.
Muslim women have been attacked, you know, because of prejudices. And I've always had compassion towards that. But it's always different when you feel it, you know, when you experience that. But on a lighter note, I always like to ask people who write for kids, what do the kids say after reading your comic?
Oh, I've been so happy with the response from kids. It's been great. They read it and they'll read it again. So that is exactly what I wanted. It's an easy read too. It's not like a difficult read. I purposefully meant for it to be something inviting, because I think when you talk to a lot of people that make comics, they say like, oh, I didn't read as much as when I was a kid, or it never struck me. But then I got a comic book and, you know, I love the pictures and I would read. So, you know, that sense of like, I love reading and I love having a book in my hand, that's what I wanted. And that's what I'm getting from kids too. They're on their like third or fourth time reading. It's so fun to hear that.
That was Oakland cartoonist Wahab Agarmi. His graphic novel is Almost Sunset, and you can pick it up at your favorite bookstore. Coming up, you ever wonder what it must have been like to be in the Beatles? Well, Paul McCartney's rare photo collection gives us an idea, and these amazing images are right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Beatle fandom was like no other when the band debuted back in the 60s. I imagine some of you listening might have been at one of their concerts screaming and singing along with the group. As the world's obsession with these four young men from Liverpool, England was rising, Paul McCartney was capturing their new rock star life through his camera. Eyes of the Storm features behind-the-scenes photos from the Beatles' tour in Europe and the U.S. in 1963 through 1964. And you can see this awesome exhibit at the De Young Museum in San Francisco. There are 250 photos plus other really cool significant items from Paul McCartney's archive. And here to tell us more is the museum's photo curator and Beatles fan, Sally Martin-Katz. Welcome, Sally.
Hi, Janae. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy you're here. Oh, I love this exhibit. And like I said, I didn't grow up on the Beatles, but I think even if you're just a music fan in general, you can appreciate this exhibit. I had no idea Paul McCartney could take photos like that.
Neither did I. And I think the rest of the world, this is the first time that these photographs have seen the light of day, as this exhibition was really a real discovery, kind of serendipitous discovery that McCartney made during the pandemic in 2020, when he was going through his archive, organizing an exhibition of his late wife, Linda Eastman McCartney's photographs. Mm-hmm. And turned to his archivist and said, hey, I made photographs in the 1960s. I'd love to, you know, why don't we pull those out and see if they're any good? And they looked at them and turns out they're really quite good. And that's kind of the genesis of the exhibition, which began at the National Portrait Gallery in London and has opened just about not yet a month ago at the De Young.
Wow. That's amazing that he had those stored somewhere and just didn't even, I guess, remember them or anything like that.
Exactly. It's amazing now, 60 years later, him rediscovering these pictures and going through them, almost using them to transport him back in time to this exciting moment, really at the height of Beatlemania.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I was impressed that, you know, for an amateur, he took such really amazing shots. And you gave us a tour, which was really awesome, too. And I learned so much from you. Thank you so much. Can you talk about his photography background? Because I recall on the tour that you said photography had been a part of his family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. McCartney had an early interest in photography that dates back to his childhood experimentations with his family's Kodak Brownie box camera, which was really the first camera that was cheap, easily accessible, and really put photography into the hands of the masses. It really did a lot to popularize photography and democratize it. And so he hadn't already established a familiarity with the camera and with photography. So it was nothing new to him when each one of the Beatles actually was handed as a gift a Pentax 35 millimeter SLR camera at the start of their trip. And McCartney really took to it. And he had experimented with his brother, Mike McCartney, who was a photographer. And then, lo and behold, photography remained to be a huge part of his life as he then married Linda Eastman, who was a photographer. And then their daughter, Mary McCartney, is also a photographer. So, needless to say, photo has always been a part of his life. But he's rediscovering these and I think, the exhibition's not trying to set out to position McCartney as the greatest undiscovered photographer, but rather as, to give a more holistic sense of his artistic contributions, to understand him beyond just the musical legend that we know him to be, but to see that he also was a very skilled photographer and had a keen artistic eye, and to see him as an artist in a greater sense, in a larger sense of it. And the photographs are really quite good.
They're very, very good.
Yeah,
They're
he
very, very,
has.
yeah. And I'm thinking as a journalist, because as you said on the tour, that these are photos that a journalist wouldn't have taken. Only someone who was in the Beatles, could have
Exactly.
taken those photos. So that's what's really special about them.
Yeah.
I love the quote right before you even enter the museum. There's this quote on the building, and from Paul McCartney, and he says, "As much as the world loved gazing at us, we love returning their gaze." And I kind of was like, it almost made me think of you're watching us, but we're watching you too, which I thought was really, really neat. What does that say about Paul McCartney as a photographer and agency when he's like, "Hey, you looking at me, we looking right back at you"?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really the crux of the exhibition. It's about reversing that gaze. It's about turning the camera. And so, they were the object of the world's scrutiny, of the world's the media attention. Fans all over the world were looking at them. This was a heavily documented moment in time. They were an overnight sensation and a phenomenon that really had no precedent in terms of any kind of cultural musical figure at that level. And this was a heavily documented event, but we get to see this from another perspective. And so it's taking something, a period in time that is that we all can recall pictures of the Fab Four descending from the plane, or people might, remember watching them on the Ed Sullivan Show, that 73 million viewers were, tuned in to watch that. But we've seen it from, we now get to see it from the other side of the lens, from the other side of the camera. So we get to experience the show and this moment in time through his own eyes, as if we're standing in his shoes, looking out onto the sea of journalists, onto this hordes of fans that were clamoring to catch a glimpse of the band. So it really becomes immersive. And that's what I think is so special about these photographs, is that we get to almost relive or live that moment in time through their eyes and try to understand what it might have felt to have the whole world's eyes on you and to be a Beatle, and what it meant to negotiate life as a Beatle
And
in
to
their
be
new
so
form of
young.
stardom. And to be so young, he was like 21 years old. They're four young boys who are just, we get to watch as they themselves are discovering their superstardom. So we're along for the ride, and you get to see the world through his lens, this sort of sense of awe and wonder that he had for, all that they were discovering, coming to America for the first time, going to Paris, all of this being, this whirlwind of a 3-month period. And so these photographs are all taken only in the brief span of those 3 months. But really, from December 1963 through February 1964. And they give us sort of a play-by-play of what it meant to be on this journey. And so it's documentary in nature, in terms of, documenting here, we did this, then we did that, and we played here, we went there. but they also demonstrate his really strong artistic eye. That's visible from the compositions, the angles. He's an artist.
Would you
You can see
say,
that.
you know, the title of this exhibit is Eyes of the Storm, and I felt like his camera was kind of the calm in the storm, because I imagine, I have to imagine too, I mean, even though they were young, I'm sure at times it was overwhelming. And I feel like him having that the camera kind of maybe gave him, again, some calm, some peace, and some power too, as well.
I mean, I think it does give you that distance. I know a lot of photographers talk about that, the camera sometimes being a way to mediate, in a sense, what you are experiencing, because he's photographing as he's in it. He's not a witness, a bystander photographing what's going on. He's an actor in the scene. He's part of it. And so I think holding up the camera too, it becomes a way, and using it, looking through the lens, is a way for him to make sense of what it is that they're experiencing. I see the camera as a tool to make sense of the world, to make sense of what you're going through, and also as an attempt to sort of freeze time and freeze these moments as they're moving in rapid succession from place to place. He gets to sort of, freeze it for a moment, and by revisiting them, he gets to come back to that moment, which is really special. But I think also, the camera too, it's a shield in a sense. And I love this almost like this confrontation of cameras that you see so many pictures in the show where McCartney's taking a picture of the journalists who are shoving their
Right.
cameras into his face. And he's not working with a zoom lens. This is a fixed
Yeah, this is
standard.
a like old school
They're
fixed
up
camera.
close.
Yeah.
And so we see it when you look at it. You're immersed. You see all these cameras coming at them. It makes you feel like you're in it. And it's almost like, is it a defense? Like he's then putting his camera right back up at them. This
Yeah.
face off between these lenses,
Yeah,
which I kind of like that idea.
it really takes you there, really takes you back to that time. And I also found it interesting too, his looking at his gaze of the US, and some of the images that he had. Like in DC, there's images of working class people on the railroads, you know, that he took photos of. And also too, the first time he saw a gun, that they saw a gun. So he was a police officer in the US, and so they have photos of that. And I really appreciate too, for people, when you attend, if you go to the Textile Hall, which is adjacent to the main exhibit hall, there were photos of the Beatles with Black American artists, the Exciters, and Clarence Frogman Henry. And after I saw the exhibit, I had looked them up, and I read that one of the members from the Exciters has said that they were supposed to perform at the Gator Bowl because they opened for the Beatles, and they were supposed to perform for the Gator Bowl in Florida, but the venue said that they couldn't perform if the Exciters were going to perform. So this was around the time of segregation, and the Beatles said they weren't going to perform if the venue wouldn't allow them, and so they changed their minds. And so the Exciters ended up performing, and because the Beatles was like, we're not performing at a segregated venue, we're not gonna like segregate, you know, our opening artists. And I just thought too how this exhibit also just reflects history, you know, during the era and the issues of the time. Can you talk about that? Just how like we see history too as well, not just with the Beatles, but just what was going on in the world, in the country at that time.
Absolutely. I mean, the photos, they are of their time. And this, I mean, the 1960s, that this was, there was a lot happening there between, civil rights, assassination of JFK, RFK, Vietnam War. I mean, this was a really, and the Beatles, this was a really, kind of pivotal moment in American history too. And I think coming from Britain, they had an outsider's perspective on the US. And I think that's important to note too, that they were, coming from the outside, looking in at the US. What were the things, it's important to note, what were the things that stood out to them? So yeah, you brought up both the, the policeman with the gun. They were shocked. He had never seen anything like that before, and were fascinated and shocked by the presence of guns on American streets, even when in the hands of law enforcement. It was just something that was not within their visual sort of field of vision or their visual vocabulary. So that was something they found shocking, just as the racial divisions in America they found absolutely shocking. and incomprehensible. And they were adamant about that they would not perform in segregated venues. They even had a clause in all of their contracts at the time that stated that they would not perform in segregated venues, which would have even violated the new Civil Rights Act. But that still, despite that, that still went on. And many other, musical acts routinely performed in segregated venues, but the Beatles would not participate in any of that. And so they were adamant about that, and also very much, gave credit to the Black American musicians who were great influences on them and in them crafting their unique sound. I mean, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, they're very, very indebted to Black American musical artists who they would whose music they also would continue to return to over the course of their careers.
Well, and we have a couple more minutes, Sally. I could talk to you about this for a long time because it's so fascinating. Information is just really, really, really interesting. My favorite item, because it's not just photos, there's other materials from his archive. And my favorite item was the spiral notepad paper where Paul McCartney wrote in his handwriting back then in the 60s, "I want to hold your hand." I'm a writer, so I love seeing writers' writings. Talk, briefly too about just some of the other things that are in the archive, and not just photos, but
yeah. I mean, it's not just the photographs, but I think the point of the show too is to really pull back the curtain and give us this intimate view into this moment in time. And that's really what it is about. And so I love the details and touches of getting to see those personal items, getting to see the notebook where I wrote the lyrics to "I Want to Hold Your Hand." I mean, to just get to see that in the handwriting, it humanizes them. It's about making, understanding. I think you leave the exhibition with an understanding of McCartney and the other Beatles as human beings and as four friends, and their whole community that surrounded them, whether it was the manager, their roadies, the chauffeur, their girlfriends, their family members that were there, that it really paints a whole picture of them as people and their community, and of their process. But I love seeing things like that, the ticket to the Christmas show that they played in the UK. And another and their itinerary for Paris. I mean, just things like that that you never would have access to seeing. So it's really a special opportunity to get access to these rare previously unseen documents, but then primarily the photographs too. I mean, this is the shots that he took are images that nobody else could have
No,
taken.
nobody else.
No photojournalist or press photographer or anyone would have had the access and the connection and ability to show. You really see the bonds that existed between the band members, and he has this intimacy that really comes through in the pictures that only somebody from the inside and part of it would be able to make. So it's really special. We see them as people. We see John Lennon with his thick glasses on that he apparently never wanted anyone to see him in, biting his nails in the back seat of the car on the way to a performance. No one, or George sleeping in the back seat of the car, conked out. No one would have ever been able to take that shot. So it really allows us to almost rewrite this narrative of this moment in time from the personal perspective.
It's a great exhibit. And Sally, I had a ton more other questions to ask, but we're out of time. Thank you so much. I really encourage everybody to check this out. Sally Martin Katz is the photo curator at the De Young Museum, and Paul McCartney's Eyes of the Storm collection is on display now until July 6th. And speaking of music, next up, I chat with Oakland Gay Men's Chorus and their upcoming concert, excuse me, about their upcoming concert this weekend. So keep it locked right here.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. This weekend, the Oakland Gay Men's Chorus is going to lift audiences' hearts with some good music, singing, and stories. That music you hear is from them right now. Their upcoming concert is called Every Voice Matters, and you can see it at the Odell Johnson Performing Arts Center on the campus of Laney College in Oaktown. This is the Oakland Gay Men's Chorus's 26th season, and joining me is their new artistic director, Bruce Southard, and Steve Smith, who is a longtime member of the chorus and serves on their board. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm so excited you all are here and just all the great things. I love choruses, so I'm just excited too that you all are having this concert this weekend. Bruce, you're the new artistic director. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm really enjoying this work with the chorus.
Yeah. And this will be your first concert?
This is my first concert with them, yes.
And Bruce, you've led other choruses. What is special about the Oakland Gay Men's Chorus?
I find the sense of community in the group it's very endearing. It draws me in. And one of the things I have been finding, and one of the things I hoped for when I took the position, was that I get just as much out of the community as I pour in to the artistic work. And I'm finding that to be very fulfilling for me.
Yes, yes. And Steve, you've been a part of the chorus for 20 years?
Yeah, just about 20 years. It's a third. But there you go.
That's a long time. So that tells me that they're very much important to you as well.
Sure. What Bruce said about community, it's surprising. I needed a refuge in 2006, and this was a big surprise that this group would become my tribe. And they did a surprising thing when I joined. They allowed a straight person into a gay men's chorus, and they did it because the board at that time said that they had been marginalized themselves so much that they were not about to do that to anybody else. They would rather be inclusive than exclusive, which was a kind of an unusual step to take in 2006.
Yeah.
We're not all that far from the beginning of the gay chorus movement. So it was great that they decided to open up a little bit.
Yeah, because how I got connected with you all was from Susan Brown. And so she told me, she was like, she's also hosts a podcast. And she was like, you don't have to be a gay man to be in the chorus.
No, there's always been, well, trans people were always in the chorus from the very beginning, but women joining is fairly new, and we're so, so happy to have women too. It just feels like more of the world is welcome.
And choruses, it's a whole thing. Like, I was looking up about gay choruses. There's like conferences, and it's a thing.
Oh, let Bruce tell you about Gala. Every 4 years, there's this marvelous, marvelous gathering of the tribes, and it's a great thing.
Okay, how many people come out to the big conference or gathering? It's a national thing, right? Yeah, like how is it, like tens of thousands or thousands, small thousands? Like how many people?
I actually don't know, so I'll let Steve answer that, because I haven't been to a big conference yet. I've just been to a smaller leadership symposium.
Oh, got it. Okay. Well, yeah. I've been to Gala itself before the pandemic in Denver, and it moves around. It goes from one city to another. There's a gay chorus in an awful lot of cities, small towns, big cities. And so it's thousands of people. We take over maybe three of the largest venues in the downtown of a city, like Denver or Minneapolis or whatever. We applaud for each other a lot, because it's great to have an audience that's likely to understand what you're up to and to appreciate what you've achieved. That's wonderful. And you have 27 minutes per chorus. You have to get on, get off like that.
Okay.
And it's some of it's truly marvelous. The big cities do some amazing things with, they have more than 27 minutes. They get a chunk in the morning, that kind of stuff.
I just imagine it must be fun just to get together and just sing, just sing. I love those kind of, conventions like that.
Janae, you sing, right?
Am I what?
You sing, right?
Not professionally. In the shower.
Well, Yeah,
I do. I do karaoke.
Sing with us. That's all.
Steve has been trying. The first time I talked to Steve, Steve was like, "We got Susan. We're gonna get you." And I was like, "Now wait a minute, Steve. I just met you. You trying to get me to join? You trying to get me to join the chorus?" You don't know how I sound. But I do want to go back to, because you all do have a concert coming up, which is why you're here. And the theme is everyone's voice matters. So talk about, you know, why you came up with the theme, who came up with the theme, all of that. Break it down.
The theme I inherited because they had to do advertising before they hired me. The theme comes directly from the mission of the chorus, is that all of us have voices that matter. And it, I mean, it's a timely theme. And there are a lot of people who feel like their voices are being minimalized or being taken away or suppressed. And so it really is a timely message. So I was grateful to inherit the theme.
Yeah. You want to add something, Steve?
Well, yeah, Bruce has chosen well what we're singing, and he's shaped things really well. Since I've been singing for these 20 years, things are recycled. They come back. And fortunately, that helps me when I'm trying to memorize the whole thing. But there are beautiful things from our past that we're having a chance to sing again that are very timely now, because we're in a political moment when once again we're in the crosshairs, and we can't afford to be quiet about it. We have to sing out, and some of the songs that we're doing in this concert speak to that, and they do a great job.
I was going to ask you how, you know, during, and you know, Bruce, you can answer this too, how do you all pick the songs, like, you know, when you're getting ready to perform, preparing to perform, what's the process like?
Well, normally I have a very long process, but I didn't have that much time this go around. I usually try to plan way out ahead so that I can spend time in the summer just going through tons of music to see what fits together. Mm-hmm. And I usually try, I try not to do things song by song, but kind of look at an overall, where are we headed, where we're starting, where we're going, and how, you know, if we do something heavy, what are we going to do after that that is going to change, you know? And so I try to make those types of considerations. And I gave them a lot of music for which they have it all memorized. It's very impressive.
Okay.
Yes.
I expect that. I expect that. I have high expectations of you guys.
Yeah. Susan was not so sure about the memorizing, but it happened, and she's got that down, and she's also dancing.
Oh, she is.
Fabulous. Yeah, she's having a swell time. And she brought her mom to rehearsal last night. Her mom is a choreographer and a teacher, and she did a little dancing for us. She enhanced things for us.
Which leads me, well, I was going to ask you, what songs can we expect? What kind of, you know, performances? So Susan's going to dance.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And what is she, can you tell us, like, what is she going to dance to? I know Susan's like, why are y'all putting me out like that?
Oh, she'll forgive us.
She will.
I don't remember exactly what, when she's, cause they're in rehearsal, they're behind me.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know exactly what she's dancing to, but we have some traditional choral music, and some, you know, newer, more classical oriented choral music. We have a little bit of Broadway show type music. Mm-hmm. We have some pop music on there, and including which I wasn't sure that they would buy into this. There's an English pop singer who's become one of my favorites, Emily Sunde. Mm-hmm. We're doing one of her tunes, and the chorus is really getting into it and enjoying it, and I that does my heart good when I see that. So we have a variety. There's a little something of everything.
A little something for everybody. Steve, are you gonna be singing lead?
Me? No, I have a policy. I don't do solos. I don't like to be anywhere without you know, at least one partner. So
okay.
The soloists in this show. Oh. Janae, they're wonderful. There's a piece called Testimony, mm-hmm. Which is a classic piece in the gay choral movement. And it's, well, Bruce mentioned there are some things that are lighter, some things that are heavier. Testimony is one of those that's difficult, but really important and really uplifting in the end. Anyway, the soloists for that, you just wouldn't believe the variety and the talent and the pathos. Everything is there for these individuals to do individually, and I admire them so much because I don't do it.
Bruce, is there a song that you're looking forward to them singing?
All of them. I really love text. And when they do, there's a song we're doing from the musical Ragtime called Make Them Hear You.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. And when they actually become intentional about the text, they sing it so convincingly. Mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to that.
That's a powerful song.
Yeah. And when we have text, it has to mean something, you know, and sometimes, you know, we can get in that mode where we're just singing word by word and just kind of rambling through something. But when we intentionally focus on what does this mean and what are we going to do and what we're going to say. And the second time we went through it last night at rehearsal, they were making me believe them. And I love that.
I love when art speaks to you like that, where, like you said, the artist makes you believe and you can just really feel it like that. Yeah, especially with music. And then just to hear all those voices together, I know that must really be heart-touching. Yeah. Okay, so I understand, now Steve, don't try and pull me into this, but I understand that you're having auditions for the chorus in April that's coming up for people who may be interested in joining for community, joining because they like good music and want to meet folks.
We do. We have auditions regularly throughout the year. When we're busy preparing a concert, we're not prospecting at that point. But once we have performed, then we start looking and responding to people who are interested. Bruce, do you know the date for that?
We'll have an open rehearsal on Tuesday, April 8th at 7:15 at First Presbyterian. And then we'll hold auditions on April 12th. That's a Saturday from noon to 2 o'clock at the church. And most of that should be out on the website and a way to contact the membership chairperson who can get everybody contacted is out there.
Okay.
So if Janae is like nervous about her audition, can you assure her it's really kind of fun?
It's a painless audition.
Good.
Yeah, it's just checking range and matching a few pitches here and there and how you memorize tones. That's it's very simple.
Okay, so I don't have to sound like Aretha Franklin too.
No.
Okay. I don't know why Steve's trying to pull me into this. No.
It's a community that works, and we would love to have you.
Real quick, as we wrap up, I just want to real quick, what does singing do for you? Just especially during these times right now. I know when I'm feeling down, I singing a good song just lifts my heart. For you, you know, real quick, each of you, what does singing do for you?
Oh. Well, it takes care of my health. It makes me, it lifts me up no matter what sort of a day or a week I've had. It allows me to breathe. It allows me to join with others. And I'm so grateful because I didn't start singing till I was 52 years old.
Wow. Bruce, what about you?
I've been, you know, singing forever, and it keeps me grounded. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will sing every day, even if no one is listening, because it feels like it just centers me. It puts me in a more focused space. And so I enjoy singing. I love singing.
All right. Well, that's beautiful. And I feel the same way as you both. It was a pleasure talking to you both and a lot of fun. Bruce Southard is the artistic director of the Oakland Gay Men's Chorus. And Steve Smith is a board member and longtime singer in the chorus. Their Every Voice Matters concert is this Saturday and Sunday at Laney College in the Odell Johnson Performing Arts Center. And you can get tickets at the Oakland Gay Men's Chorus website. And we'll have a link on our webpage. Thank you.
Thank you.
And before I go, I want to tell you about a special woman. Her name is Marianne Bird. I met Marianne when I was an intern at Time Magazine in London back in 2005, and it was my first time overseas. Marianne was a reporter and editor at Time, and she immediately reached out to me and said I could come to her for anything. And we were one of the few Americans working in that newsroom. She was older than me and originally from New Jersey, and she and I kept in touch for 20 years via letters. Yes, letters, mail. She encouraged me in my journalism career, and several weeks ago, I was planning to send her a letter to tell her that finally my dream of having my own radio show had come true. But instead, I received a letter from her family. Marianne had died in London. She was 74 years old, and her birthday was just a few days ago this week. And during her journalism career, Marianne covered stories related to human rights and environmentalism. And it's because of people like her that I'm able to do what I'm doing today. So I just want to salute her. And I also want to mention another special woman, Hermelinda Raphael. She is the grandmother of our Sights and Sounds producer, Porfirio Rangel. Miss Hermelinda recently passed away at the age of 96. Porfirio told me that she loved watching WWE, yes, wrestling with him in her 90s too. And so my heart goes out to his family and Marianne's family. So, you know, just take care of your elders, keep them close. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. Next week, you'll hear from the cast of the new movie, Freaky Tales. And we'll have another great show for you right here again next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other. Next up is the Arts Hour from the BBC.